She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. Thank you so much for joining us. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to. And we are going to give you lots to think about today. Thanks for joining us. We have another incredible content-rich show lined up. In studio with me today are Drs. Diana Liverman and Jonathan Overpeck, known by many as Peck, even on the website. They are co-directors of the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment, and they are both internationally recognized and have received numerous prestigious awards for their work. And I said to Diana before we went on air, I'm not going to read all that you guys have accomplished because that would be the 20 minutes of an hour show. And it's people can Google you and find out. And I don't want to make small of it, but we have some really important topics to cover and things to share. And just a little announcement, the show is sponsored by the Fairfax Companies, who are the leader in Southern Arizona in construction recycling, waste recycling, and the production of green waste. They're doing great things for the planet all over the Southwest. And I want to mention again, because it's one of my funniest pet projects, that Golden Eagle Distributors and Anheuser-Busch are partnering to promote World Environment Day through their Grow One, Save a Million campaign. And leave it to Budweiser to figure out how to connect beer to growing a beard. And they're doing a good job of it. They have a campaign and tell us that the average guy uses 5 gallons of water every time they shave. And Budweiser is actually trying to get enough guys to pledge to do this between now. There's only about 2 weeks left, and they've already saved about 13,000 gallons. So they're not getting close to their million. But the way I look at it, just save water. Who uses 5 gallons of water up to shave? Mr. Green does not, but then also your opportunity to grow a beard is there. So check out the Budweiser page on Facebook. It's quite humorous. And then please don't forget to listen to me live here every Saturday at MrsGreensWorld.com. You can listen on your iPhone or Droid or on your computer. And if you do miss me, please remember that the shows live on my website and they're right there for your listening pleasure. Any questions? info@MrsGreensWorld. And I want to do a shout out at the beginning of the show and at the end. My guest next week is Chris Jordan, who I've been trying to get on the show for just about as long as I've been trying to get Jonathan. So it's all coming around. He is an internationally acclaimed wildlife photographer, and he was a life changer for me. So let's go. Diana, the short story is that you provide your co-leader, co-director of the Institute, and your focus is responsibilities for social science and policy, which is basically the social part, the human end of it. And Peck, yours is environmental science, the more physical science. Is that a fair representation of the big roles and responsibilities that you each share?
Yes, I think so. Though I would say that after, I think, 30 years of working on environmental issues, I've learned a lot of science. And I think the more I listen to the Peck, the more he talks social science. So I think even though we come from slightly different backgrounds, we've both ended up being very interdisciplinary. And if you want to work in this field, it's important to be able to talk to both groups.
More than ever. The integration of it. It's not scientists off doing their things in labs. Now we have everything transparent, and it's really important for people to understand the integration of that because things have changed very dramatically, even in the last 30 years, I think, in terms of let's let people know what's going on. But let one of you talk about what is the Institute of the Environment. It's not a very old organization in terms of its living at the University of Arizona. So tell about how that got started and how it's growing. I mean, it's one of my favorite places to hang out.
Well, it all started when we founded it. But it is built on a really rich history of environmental work at the University of Arizona and in the community. And it came most directly from the Institute for the Study of Planet Earth, which I directed before. And part of our endeavor at that time was to look at just part of the environmental science spectrum, both social and physical and biological, by the way. But it really wasn't soup to nuts environment. And a lot of people on campus wanted to start being everything environmental. And we had the strength in most of those areas that were necessary to do that. And by hiring Diana back from Oxford University in the UK, we had the leadership we needed to do this. And so we made this big, bold step that would make the environmental enterprise at the University of Arizona much more interdisciplinary and across all disciplines that this huge university represents.
And it's I don't know, it's new paradigm thinking. And I think it's really good to go into a little bit about the certain areas, because who wants to take to secure sustainable food and water systems? What you're doing has global impact. So talk about that one, because to me, the integration is what you're doing.
Well, just building a little bit on what Peck was talking about, University of Arizona has enormous strength in the environment. We've probably got 300 researchers all working on environmental issues. And partly from the University of Arizona's land grant tradition of sort of extension and working on issues around food, we have a lot of people who are focused on these basic needs, like how do we have secure water? How do we feed the world? And we're working everything from the very local to local ranchers and local planners to the global level. But we have, although we try to cover the whole environment, there are some areas that we have particular expertise in. I always say that University of Arizona's drowning in water expertise. We really are one of the, probably the best water places to study water in the world. And that's everything from the basic science of water to water law and sort of water in the developing world. But we've also recently been developing a big focus on renewable energy, particularly solar, another thing that makes a lot of sense
here. In the Southwest.
And then Peck and I, of course, reflect our interest in climate. And that's not just climate change, but also drought and natural disasters, those sorts of things. And then we have great strength in at U of A in ecosystems, people who are concerned with protecting biodiversity and the ecology of the sort of local and the global area. So all of those are big areas of emphasis where we've got clusters of faculty and graduate students come here from all over the world to study in those areas.
And I don't think it's an exaggeration, and I've told lots of people at the U of A this, I could do a show, not a week, I could do a show a day spotlighting the University of Arizona and the work that's going on there. I mean, there a month doesn't go by that I don't have an interview with somebody from the U of A, and we just kind of try and time it out because I love it to be a national show, but the things that you're doing have global implications. In the writing of this and in the thinking of this for me, a lot of the things that you do create economic opportunities. And I think that it's again, back to my point of not having this just be a scientific community, but applied science and how you take what you learn and what happens in the labs and in the minds and in the conversations and create economic opportunities, not just here, but globally. So can you talk about that a little bit, Peck?
Right. And this goes to that land grant tradition that the University of Arizona has. And it really is a focus not just on solving environmental problems, not just on scholarship and things going on in a laboratory. It's about making these things really useful. And it's also about creating opportunities, and in particular, economic opportunities and opportunities to improve our quality of life while still making our economic well-being better. And a good area to focus on there would be either the water or energy. You could do it across any environmental discipline. But in the area of water, we have a water problem in semi-arid systems. And around the world, the water issues and crises
growing,
are becoming
growing.
Growing. Right. So part of this is let's figure out ways to solve those problems. But at the same time, let's create technologies, things you can make, and energy knowledge solutions, things that might be on your computer, that would actually bring money to the private sector partners that we work with. And the same thing with renewable energy. We're solving a problem with renewable energy, but we're also creating a much better economic engine for the United States and Arizona, because no longer are we importing as much energy, or hopefully in the future it'll get better than it is now. But as we curb climate change, reduce air pollution, we're building an industry at home that is American jobs that will make our economy stronger and more robust in the face of these world recessions and things.
And it's really great to see just in the growth since Mrs. Green was born 4 years ago, some of the new things that have happened. I mean, it's the partnerships and the work with TEP and the research park and all of the solar advancements. It's pretty encouraging. So let's talk a little bit about, I mean, next week is an exciting week because I think there's a huge piece of this that I learned when I participated just very much on the fringe with Scilog, where you bring great minds that are sharing information and sharing expertise, and you might know something that somebody else doesn't, so it accelerates the entire process of change. So you have this conference coming up, Adaptation Futures International Conference on Climate Adaptation, and you really do have some of the world's top thinkers, the game changers, the what I call the early adopters. That's one of my favorite phrases these days because I think I am one. And the many benefits of sharing the information. I think you, 500 people, 800 people?
800
people coming to Tucson at the end of May, and hopefully in nice air-conditioned rooms.
They're coming for the weather.
They are. They're coming for the weather, right, the 105 weather. Good to see climate change in action. So talk a little bit about the excitement and the benefits that that brings to the entire planet.
Well, I am very excited to have some of the top people in the world. I mean, we have the chief scientist for the UN Environment Program. We have leading researchers and practitioners from countries that are very vulnerable to storms and to sea level rise. Like, we have a group from Bangladesh. We have a big delegation from Australia who see lots of parallels between the challenges they're facing with forest fires and with drought and what we're facing in the Southwest. So the goal is to come together and exchange ideas. And there's really sort of two foci. One is to bring people together who are trying to cope with just current climate variability.
Right, right.
You know, so severe storms, drought. But we're also looking to the future because it's pretty clear to many people that the climate is changing and that we need to think about how to live on a warmer planet because we may not be able to or be willing to prevent that climate change. And so some of the issues that people are going to be talking about is, how could we live in a world that might be 6 degrees Fahrenheit warmer? What would we need to do to adapt to that? And so it really is very action-oriented as well. And I think the other area that's going to be very interesting is that many of the big development agencies and conservation organizations, humanitarian organizations, they're really worried about disaster risk reduction and about climate change. And we have some of the top people who are looking at how can we do development whilst also having it be resilient to some of these changes in the climate. So I'm very excited that we have a lot of people coming from the Global South to share their strategies. And in many cases, they're doing more than we are in the United States to try to reduce their vulnerability to some of these changes and events.
And it's, to me, the excitement is, I mean, just from the people I've had on the show, is people are starting to talk to each other. As ridiculous as that may sound, it's the integration of all these and the application of them so that it's not the conversation in the scientific community.
Now, could I just add one thing for your listeners? Because I think this is going out before the conference, that we will be webcasting the plenary speakers, the main speakers, from our website, if people are interested.
From your own website?
From the Institute of the Environment.
Okay. Yeah. And I'll write that up, too.
Yeah, and people can still register for the conference, though it's a little bit expensive because we are providing so much to people, so.
And that's okay. And most of us would not want to be participating in the conference unless there were some public forums, because I've gone, like when I went to Scilog, it's a lot of science talk.
It's pretty technical.
It's really, really technical. Yeah. So it's not what the public wants to know is how does this impact my life, which that's one of the great results that'll come about from this because we're all feeling the impact of that and living consciously. It drives me crazy. Now, what about on a little bit of a sad note to me, there is the conference coming up in Rio that is 40 years old. And from what I understand from another guest and from you, the Rio Plus 20 Earth Science, and you're going, no major representation from the United States government, or what do you think?
Well, it is a really important meeting. It's really important. Rio Plus 20. It's the big opportunity for the leaders of the world to come together and act on the environment. But it's not just the US that seems to be preoccupied with other things. There are a lot of European leaders who aren't going, and it is disappointing. I'm going partly to attend some science events to try to share the latest science with people attending the summit. The two areas that they're talking about are the green economy, which of course is important to the US, and also looking at the sort of reform of government for it to be more sustainable. There are US leaders going, but they tend not to be the top people in our government. And I do wish that we were participating and taking the leadership that we did 20 years ago and 40 years ago, where the US was really seen as a leader and visionary on thinking about how to cope with environmental issues. But I think we're preoccupied with other things like the economic recession and the election.
The election. It's like nothing really happens between now and November except a lot of mudslinging. And even locally here, it's pretty devastating to see some of the ugliness that it brings out, which is exactly the same as we haven't been saying global warming. We've been talking about climate change, because I love it when some radio talk show host says, oh, yeah, look at all that global warming, that snow in Atlanta. And I want to get on the radio and say, excuse me, it's called climate change. Read beyond the title. Okay, what about some of the other things that you're doing at the Institute of the Environment? I think the Institute is unique in that, first of all, in challenging economic times, it got started. It's very robust. It's growing. You have programs that I would like to talk about. So in terms of other things that you're doing there, what do you want to share with the listeners? You have something called, that I did not know about, Climate Assessment of the Southwest. Talk about that.
Well, we have a host of programs now that are related to this climate assessment for the Southwest, or CLIMAS, as we like to call it.
CLIMAS. Okay, thank you.
And but climate assessment for the Southwest. We also most recently obtained money from the Department of Defense for working with their installations in the Southwest. And a little further back, from the Department of Interior, which manages huge amounts of land in the Southwest. Think of the national parks and the Bureau of Land Management, but they also have the Bureau of Reclamation that runs the Colorado River water system. We also got a big chunk of resources from them to run their Southwest Climate Science Center. What all of these have in common, and many smaller programs, is the idea of regional climate science. Climate science meaning bringing physical, biological, social science together that relates to climate variability and change. Variability meaning like drought and El Nino and things and its effect here. Bringing that together to work with decision makers in society so that they can not just read scientific papers, which they never do, but they can actually have more access to the knowledge as it comes out and can even get involved with us in producing that knowledge that sort of makes it much more useful for them to make better decisions. And these decisions, of course, will help them prevent disasters in their own livelihoods, but create opportunities. And it goes back to this whole thing about our philosophy of not just solving problems, but creating opportunities. And so that's what Climate Assessment for the Southwest, the Southwest Climate Science Center, and our DOD Department of Defense activities are all about: saving money for the taxpayers, saving money for individuals, excuse me, and saving money for private sector operations in the Southwest, all related to climate. And one thing I like to highlight here is there's a lot of debate about, well, do we do climate change or do we just do climate variability like drought and El Nino? And we do both because that's what people in the Southwest care about. And it's really important when we talk about climate change to pay attention to what causes it. Because it's much like when you go to the doctor, you have an ailment. Do you want them just to treat for the symptoms or do you want them to treat for the cause? And it's the same thing with climate change. We need to understand why it's occurring in order to be able to project or predict what's going to happen next and then get that information in the hands of decision makers.
And that's really a perfect analogy, because the answer to your question in the medical arena is lots of people, until recently, were treating the effect, not the cause. And now people are wanting to know, what's the cause of this? Don't just give me a pill. I want to know what's going on. And environmental impact is a huge part of that. Okay, we're going to take a short break. Please stay here with us. You're listening to Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. We have in studio with us Drs. Diana Liverman and Jonathan Overpeck from the University of Arizona's Institute of the Environment. We'll be
right back. University of Arizona Professor John Pollard asked the students in the Posada San Pedro Hall to consider bringing solar energy to the dorm. Just 3 years later, the Solar Cats, a group of students who took up the cause, have installed 44 solar panels on the dorm, saving 20,000 kilowatt hours of energy and reducing greenhouse gas emissions by 14 metric tons every year. Talk about students with a sunny future. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi, I'm Abbott Taylor. With over 35 years creating jewelry in Tucson, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Please come in and see some of the thousands of designs we have created, or come in and have us design something original just for you. Whether you're looking for a simple and stylish graduation gift, your engagement ring, or a breathtaking jewelry piece to celebrate an important birthday or anniversary, you can't beat our competitive diamond pricing. With 100% trade-up guaranteed, set in an Abbott Taylor jewelry design, always using earth-friendly recycled gold. Abbott Taylor Jewelers, exquisite jewelry designs and exceptional diamond deals created right here in Tucson for over 35 years. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
Hi, this is Mrs. Green with some great news about the all-new 2012 VW Passat. It's 2012 Motor Trend Car of the Year, best in class for legroom, and has standard Bluetooth technology. VW thought of everything by giving the Passat a brand new sleek design that conveys confidence and assertiveness. If you're looking for the best ownership experience possible and a great new Passat, visit Chapman Tucson at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan.
You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives?
Well, it's true.
It's true.
Well, it's true.
Goodwill.
Goodwill gave my son a chance.
My mom, hope.
My brother, a sense of purpose.
And help my dad find a job.
Goodwill helps thousands of people.
People like us every year.
People like us.
Every year.
Your donations to Goodwill do change lives. Please donate today.
Budweiser is asking guys to skip shaving leading up to World Environment Day. Not only can guys get an extra 5 minutes of sleep in the morning, they can save about 5 gallons of water for each shave they skip. Our goal is to save 1 million gallons of water. Help us by going to Budweiser's Facebook page and making a pledge. You can actually do less and help make a difference. So join us and grow one. Save a million.
Welcome back, everybody. You are indeed listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And as promised, we're giving you a lot to think about today. We have Drs. Diana Liverman and Jonathan Overpeck from the University of Arizona Institute of the Environment. They are both internationally recognized and have received numerous prestigious awards. But the thing that impressed me the most, having observed them here in Tucson, is what they really care about is making a difference and their passion for the climate and the health of our environment. So thank you both for taking the time to be here today. Jonathan, when we broke... I know, everybody said I should call you Peck. It just sounds like really weird. So I'm going to start trying that. I'm going to practice. So I feel like I'm part of that Institute of the Environment family. But you talked about, I think, the causes. We know about a lot of the impact. And you can go around Tucson and see rivers that have dried up. I mean, I'm from New Jersey. And when they first told me that was a wash, I was like, a wash what? In the Santa Cruz River. So there are obvious things like that. But talk about some of the causes, and then maybe Diana can talk about some of the people-related causes, the social part of that.
Right. Well, a lot of this goes back to people, because there certainly are variations in the Earth's climate that have always been going on, always will. And fortunately, we understand why they behave the way they do. And that might give us a drought, for example. But unfortunately, the big gorilla in the room now is anthropogenic climate change, or human-caused climate change. And that's the emission of greenhouse gases. The big one is carbon dioxide from fossil fuel burning. And there are a bunch of other greenhouse gases that are produced by other types of human activity. But these guys are warming the climate. That's why they call it global warming. It's warming everywhere without exception. But it's causing regional climate change that's different from region to region. And when you really come down to dealing with it, you have to understand those regional manifestations of the climate change. And here in the Southwest, it's not just warming. And like today, we're probably going to break another record. We've been breaking warm records more than twice as often as cool records, which obviously tell you something's been going on.
If you're paying attention, seriously, look at what's going on. Yes, look at the facts.
Yeah, and in March alone, in the United States alone, in the lower 48 alone, we broke 15,000 warm temperature records. That's
Let
never
facts
happened
get in
before.
The way. Yes, that's a big number. Let those facts sink in.
Yeah, so it's pretty bad. But that's not just causing warming, and it's also causing a drying. And what's happening in both hemispheres is the major position of the jet stream that everyone hears about, it's moving towards the poles, away from the equators. And as that happens, the dry zones that characterize the Southwest U.S., but also in the Southern Hemisphere, places like Australia, those are expanding and getting drier. And this is something that was predicted by the climate models and by theory, and it's actually happening. So we have a lot of confidence that this is real, and it's caused by humans. Unfortunately, the carbon dioxide that we put up through fossil fuel burning, some of those molecules are still going to be around thousands of years from now in our atmosphere. And there are processes to get them out, natural ways that the carbon dioxide gets out of the atmosphere, but a lot of it stays up for centuries. And therefore, the warming will continue for much longer. So whatever temperature we decide to turn our Earth up to is the temperature that future generations will deal with for multiple generations, many generations. So we're basically determining that now, unless we can magically figure out a way to take the CO2 out of the atmosphere, which right now is very, very costly. So that's
it's some of those great minds, the Carson Scholars. When I get so depressed, I go to any of those presentations at the U of A, and I think the hope is just around the corner. They're going to invent something. It's what I have to do to stay positive on my radio show. So, yeah, we really have to. If we stopped now, the implications are ongoing for a really long time. That's basically what you're saying, because those carbon emissions are already up there.
And that's why we pay attention to climate change adaptation, because we have to deal with what we're going to get no matter what. But we also pay a lot of attention to how do we move off of fossil fuel burning, both to clean the atmosphere and get rid of greenhouse gases, but also to build an economy that's based on jobs here rather than importing energy from around the world.
And there is no silver bullet. I mean, I interview a lot of people on my show, and I have like Winona Howder from foodandwaterwatch.org. And the only thing she wanted to talk about on the show was fracking. And it was such an upsetting show to me that I took the rest of the day off, because fracking is, to me, the devil. It is an alternative fuel source, but it's putting a lot of nasty emissions up there in the way they're doing it also. So, Diana, talk about the human element and human behavior, and also hope for... Are people listening more? You travel globally, both of you. Is there more of a collective consciousness, not just in the scientific community?
Well, let me start talking, first of all, about what we call the social driving forces, or the human driving forces of emissions or other environmental impacts. And I always think the simplest way to talk about it is there's an equation called the IPAT equation, which is impact is a result of population, how many people there are on the earth, affluence, which is how much money they have and how much they consume, and technology is which technologies they choose. And all of those are driving global environmental change. So if you have more people, they are consuming a lot of energy and their choice is fossil fuel to generate that energy, then emissions are going to increase. In terms of what we can do to change that, population growth is actually probably the one that's closest to being solved, because the latest projections and the latest analysis suggests that population growth is going to level off around 2050 at 9 billion. It's still a lot of people, but it does mean that, in fact, that the driving force has turned around because billions of women around the world have decided and chosen to have less children. So all around the world, fertility rates have dropped from 6 children per woman, and they're down at 2. And then population will probably decrease. Consumption and affluence, that's a problem because a lot of the world is becoming richer. They're becoming better off and they have a higher quality of life. So the potential for those people to consume things that have an environmental impact is serious. But they have a choice about which technologies. So if you choose technologies for your energy supply that are renewable and have lower environmental impact, then that mitigates the effect of your affluence. So can we make green choices about what we consume? And I think both with the issue of affluence and of technology, that more and more people are becoming aware that there are choices about what you consume, how much you recycle, reuse, all of those sorts of things, and that we have technology choices, that there are definitely technologies that have a lower environmental impact than others. So I think things have the potential to turn around, and we can drive policies that help to turn those things around, but they're not changing fast enough to, for example, prevent climate change. And one indication of that is a group I've been involved with that works on something called planetary boundaries, where we've tried to identify the danger zones. And we've identified 9 possible areas to do with pollution and climate change and biodiversity loss. And we're trying to look at how near we are to those boundaries and what we could do to pull ourselves back into the safe zones.
And some of the more than obvious targets, India and China, where there is massive growth in population and massive consumption, and everybody wants to drive. They all want to be like the United States and drive a car and have a cell phone and then throw them away. I mean, it's one of the, to me, Chris Jordan shows you a picture of what that looks like in terms of massive consumption. But are those some of the areas that are just the how does the United States stack up in terms of we're the ones that everybody wants to be like, but are we doing any better than the countries that are playing catch up?
No. I mean, the per capita greenhouse gas emissions of a Chinese person or an Indian person are still way, way below the US. And they also have relatively small middle classes. So we do see a few people consuming a lot, but there's still masses and masses of people who are producing 1/20th of the environmental impact that we do. I think there is hope in that both the Indian government and the Chinese government do take the environment quite seriously and are doing things. China's very worried about their vulnerability to climate change. They've had massive droughts and serious floods. So whilst they want to develop, they are starting to think about how can we develop with what we call a lower energy intensity, so produce less emissions for our growth. They are looking, the massive investment in renewables. I mean, you can hardly get solar panels and wind turbines here because the Chinese are buying so many. And in India, they're really looking at renewables for their rural poor, where people are off the grid. And so the best way to bring them out of poverty is actually to use renewable energy. So I think whilst, yes, India and China are a big footprint on the planet, it's not that they're unaware of what they might need to do to reduce that. And I don't think we can tell other people that they're not allowed to develop. What we have to do is to hope that they make better choices than we did.
Totally. Go ahead.
Well, you know, one of the ironies of this, too, is that the United States is still the leading innovator in the world. So when it comes to thinking of new solutions, both for energy that doesn't emit as much greenhouse gas, but also for efficiency, using less energy, we're the tops. And so we have to somehow figure a way for more people in the United States and elsewhere to use these new technologies, because then we can lower the carbon footprint per person and the energy intensity per person and make this earth, keep within these boundaries that Diana's talking about.
And it's not so big that everybody can't do something. And I think that's a great thing for you to talk about, that every homeowner, every apartment owner, every person that owns a car, we can all, I call it small steps, big impact. Collectively, it's one of my mantras. Just do something. If you want to cut down on your your paper towel use, that all impacts energy. If you decide that you're not going to use plastic bottles anymore, that all comes back to reducing energy because it takes water to produce them. They've got to be shipped. So there's not just getting solar panels, which is a great choice. There's living in a warmer house when it's summer and turning your thermostat up a little bit and walking around in cooler clothing than that, you know, I just want to be comfortable all the time attitude that I had probably until, I don't know, 5 years ago. It's like, folks, we got to start living a little bit differently. So there's some of the human factors that I talk about.
Yeah. I agree with you that there are small steps, but it's also important to know which one of those makes the most difference. So there was a great campaign in the UK where I spent part of the year. You can hear my accent is English.
Love it.
And they did a campaign called 10-10, which was to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 10% in 2010. And they had a list of all the things you could do. And I realized I was doing some of them, but not others. So the thermostat was a big one. Traveling less was another one. But one of the ones, of course, was eating a little bit less meat because that...
Right.
Meatless
Mondays.
Yeah. Right, and that reduces quite a lot of your greenhouse gas emissions. So there were things that you could do that actually halved your carbon footprint for the year. It wasn't just 10%. It was actually not that difficult to go to a 50% reduction.
So this is just the woman on the street question. Why can't we have that in the United States and really get active on a campaign like that? Because I think there are hundreds of millions of us that want that list. And that's what I'm trying to figure out for people. Give me the list. Tell me how I can show up. Because sometimes listeners say to me, there's so much information that you bring to us, it's daunting. I don't even know what to think about when you're having Earth Justice on 1 week and Food and Water Watch and you guys the next week. Give me some chunks that I can bite off. So what about this campaign?
Well, we at the Institute for Environment, we've actually done a bunch of fridge magnets on how to reduce water use and how to reduce energy use. And we're starting to give those to people so that they can make choices. We're not telling people what to do.
Right.
We're saying, here are some things you can do. But there are also, I mean, one of the things we know from social science research is individual action only takes you part of the way, because we're locked into things like the design of our cities. That's going to take a long time to change. Infrastructure makes it difficult. If your utility has big power stations that aren't ready to be, you know, turned off yet, it's hard to do it. So we've got to work both on the sort of institutional and infrastructural changes and on the individual changes so that we can make it easier for individuals to make those changes. And I think, so we've got to work on both of those levels.
Just make it easy for me. That's what people say to me. Just make it easy for me. I write these newsletters and I'm ranting about things and I call it another green rant. And people say, even though I'm ranting, I always give a call to action, some kind of call to action, because I think people want that. Jonathan.
You know, and one of the things that the University of Arizona is doing, and more universities have to do, and big corporations, we're the biggest job provider in the Southern Arizona. We need to work with the community more. We need to set an example, but we also have to help, just the way you're saying, so everyone else can row in the right direction together. And so the University of Arizona is one of the top-ranked green universities in the country, but that doesn't mean we're resting on our laurels. We're trying to really get serious about reducing our carbon imprint, reducing our water use. When we build new buildings, they're built to the highest environmental standards. And it's not just sitting back on campus and saying, well, we're good. You know, we have to work with the community more. And I'm really excited about the fact that the city of Tucson and the Pima County and many other organizations in Southern Arizona all seem to be coalescing around this idea of, let's be an example, not just for our country, but for the world, in how we live and thrive and have a great economy, while at the same time reducing our energy consumption, reducing our carbon footprint, reducing the amount of water we use.
And it doesn't feel like suffering. I think that that's an important part. You don't feel like you're living. I mean, I make a joke about living in a yurt, which one of my staff is living in a yurt, actually, in Colorado. And I just... there is so much wisdom to that, of saying that you can live comfortably and live your wonderful life, but still make a commitment to a more sustainable
environment.
It's so easy.
There's no reason here to compromise your quality of life.
Right.
And or any of your values. It's just a matter of let's you consume less for the same amount of good.
Right.
And we'll save money too.
Those, I know, it's all the green economy. So we are going to have to take another short break. Please stay here with us. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. We are having a content-rich conversation with Drs. Diana Liverman and Jonathan Overpeck from the Arizona University of Arizona Institute of the Environment. Stay here with us.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. Did you know that the 2012 VW Beetle has been completely redesigned, that it has exciting new features, look, and performance, and that it is one of Oprah's best things for 2012? The best news is Chapman VW has them in stock. Check out the new Beetle at Chapman VW at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan, or visit them at TucsonVW.com. Be sure to tell them that Mrs. Green sent you.
What if you had simple and easy solutions to live, work, and play green? Green Living Magazine, the premier green lifestyle magazine, brings you the latest in organic cooking, gardening, health and wellness, chef and celebrity interviews, as well as easy solutions to clean up your everyday life. Visit greenlivingaz.com for the latest in green news. Buy your subscription and view our network videos. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, and again at greenlivingaz.com.
At the University of Arizona, we're putting solar know-how to work. And it's not just our researchers. Our students are on the job as well. Our student solar racing team, using recycled solar cells from NASA, designed and built a car from scratch that gets the equivalent of over 3,000 miles per gallon. Talk about students who will go far. Really, really far. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Budweiser is asking guys to skip shaving leading up to World Environment Day. Not only can guys get an extra 5 minutes of sleep in the morning, they can save about 5 gallons of water for each shave they skip. Our goal is to save 1 million gallons of water. Help us by going to Budweiser's Facebook page and making a pledge. You can actually do less and help make a difference. So join us and grow one. Save a million.
Welcome back, everybody. The boys and girls, the men and the women are back in town today. Welcome to Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. Thanks for being a part of it. Remember, we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And remember to follow me on Facebook, Twitter. Now, my fastest growing social media message is Pinterest, which just makes me laugh at 61 years old. What is Pinterest? But there are so many ways to get the message out about sustainability, and I am happy to take care, to take advantage of every single one of them. So I have some a final thing that I want to talk about in terms of the Institute of the Environment that I think is one of the most exciting, and that's the Carson Institute, the Carson Scholars Program. I went, my husband and I actually went to one of the first presentations where the scholar spoke about what they are doing, and I missed the last one, but I'll be at the next one. So who wants to talk about the Carson Scholars Program? Stephanie will be so proud of me.
Well, I'll start. We started the Carson Scholars Program. It's named after Rachel Carson,
right,
who is one of the most important people in the environmental movement. It's the 50th anniversary of her book this year, Silent Spring, that changed the world, way we think about pollution and the environment and wildlife. And so we named the program after her because she was a great communicator. And it's a program for, that supports students. It gives them scholarships. But it's not just to support them to do their science. It's to train them in how to communicate, how to interact with communities, how to convey their research to a much broader audience. And we select from the very best students at the University of Arizona working on the environment. And we're looking for people that are changing the world and are going to make a difference. And so this is the second year. We've just selected our second group. And they are an amazing and inspiring group. They're saving the Amazon. They're saving tigers. They're coming up with new solar energy technologies. They're doing water reuse for people on the Navajo Reservation. And these sorts of programs are important, partly for the support it gives the students, because a lot of them are carrying debts. We don't pay them a lot for their work. And so it helps them financially. But I think more than anything else, it's the sense of community and the training that we're providing them on how to communicate that makes a difference.
Oh, I think it's just awesome how great the students are at the University of Arizona. We are literally attracting the very best students. And by having programs like this, that helps do that as well. So it not only is getting us to the very top of creating new knowledge and fame and fortune in science, but it's also creating this cohort who are going to go forward and do great things for the next 50 years.
And a critical part of it that I think you're doing, you talked a little bit about it earlier, is community involvement. So you're inviting people like me into the presentations. How would I know about it? I'm going to have Ty on my show next week, Ty Taylor, who I couldn't hear enough of what he had to say. And I said, he lives on top of trees in the Amazon. And I'm like, I've got to get this guy on my show. I could have a Carson Scholars program for 10 weeks because everything they talked about at 61, it's what gives me hope for the future. And some days it's hard. I wonder about if I'm going to have any kind of impact on leaving the world a better place for my grandchildren. And those kids, there's one nanotechnology that could be developed in solar that could shift things very quickly. So I hear those rays of hope, and then I keep up getting up every morning and being Mrs. Green. So I want to talk about the Dalai Lama, because I saw on your website, I love the Dalai Lama. I quote the Dalai Lama. I give public speeches about what the Dalai Lama says, which is the most important thing we can do is critical thinking followed by action and passionate commitment to what your critical thinking results in to change the world. So you got to be with the Dalai Lama, Diana.
Yes, it was one of the most interesting phone calls I ever received when a colleague called me up and said, the Dalai Lama wants to learn more about climate change. And there's a group in Boulder called the Mind Life Institute that's going to organize a private seminar. Would you be interested? And I was like, are you kidding?
Sign me up. And I have to take Mrs. Green next time. She'll carry my suitcases.
Yeah. So a group of 10 of us went to Dharamsala, to his residence in India. And we spend a week talking with him about issues of environment, ethics, and spirituality. And actually, I wish Pet could have been there as well, because what I found out was that His Holiness loves science. And it was almost as if he didn't want to talk about ethics and religion. All he wanted to talk about was climate science. And I was literally up all night reading about sort of ice cores and tree rings, trying to explain that we could tell him what the 150,000 year climate history was. So he really, really loves and respects science. He's had a lot of monks there who are trained in science who interacted with us. But he's got an amazing sense of humor. I couldn't believe how funny he was.
It's one of the things I love the most about him. Yeah. And he doesn't take himself too seriously.
And one of the things that completely gave him the giggles was when I was talking about the greenhouse gases. And I mentioned methane and where it came from. And when he actually realized that it came from basically the front and back end of cows. He completely got the giggles. And apparently he's been repeating this for a while. But he also was very thoughtful. And I came away with a sense of what partly helped me understand why I care so much. It's about relieving suffering and about compassion, not just for other people, but other species. And so it was a very special experience.
And you were there for a week?
Yeah, a week. And it was, we just were sitting in a sort of a living room in his residence. And so it was an enormous privilege. And I really am not sure I've absorbed it all yet. But it was, it certainly changed the way I think about some of the things that I do, and has changed the way he also is really believes in teaching, and it reminded me about why I'm at a university and how I enjoy teaching.
And it's just the Dalai Lama, he's all that, and like I said, you watch him and you know that he does not ever take himself too seriously. He sees himself as part of the work that has to be done, and it probably annoys him sometimes that he has to be the Dalai Lama because it's a big job. Okay, I have two more questions, one of which is in terms of relative importance. How important do you think it is to just a succinct answer to translate what you are doing on your priority list? How important is it to translate all of the work you're doing with the 300 staff, your other connections at the university, the message to the masses? And how do you do that? Because what I want to know, and if I want to know, then 10 of my friends want to know, and 10 of their friends want to know, so that we can be more engaged in living more consciously.
Well, for me, and I'm sure Diana's pretty much in the same boat, at least half my time goes into communicating, figuring out better ways to communicate,
right,
translating. No one size fits all in this business. You really have to get to know decision makers, people in the public from different backgrounds, say different faith groups, different political backgrounds. You just have to come to them with the knowledge in a form that they find they can digest, that they're comfortable listening and having a dialogue. And one of the things I like, going back to the Carson Fellows, that's really marvelous, is this new generation, not just them, they're much more interested in communicating than just doing the science, which in my generation, you know, a lot of my colleagues still will not come out of the lab. They just see it as a bad thing to do. But what good is the taxpayer research, funded research, unless it actually gets out and is used?
An application for it. I could not agree with you more. And go ahead, Diana.
I think, there are areas that we could do a lot better, both generally as a research community, but also at University of Arizona. And so one of the challenges I'm really thinking about over the next few years is how do we better engage the business community and how do we better engage the non-governmental community? I mean, we have very strong links with government,
at federal
and local levels. But I believe that if we're going to solve these problems, we can learn a lot from the business community that's taking sustainability seriously. We can learn a lot from the NGO community. So part of our goal is to create better partnerships with them. So we do that both at university through linking up to the Eller College of Management. But I've really sort of taken it on to try to spend a lot more time talking to the business community about what we can do together on the environment, because there's a lot of business leaders out there who care deeply about the environment and the future, because it's the sustainability of their companies as well as the planet.
And especially in the Southwest. And I think the timing could not be better, being out in the business community and being a small business owner. The winds of change are blowing with new leadership in major positions like at the chamber, the mayor's office. I mean, he's all that. He's doing a lot to make a difference and is totally committed to the environment. And I think that the community forums that the university does, incorporating when you have great minds, if one or two of them giving a talk and getting the word out about that talk, it is a way to grow things virally in the community, because sometimes they're standing room only, because we have people in this community that want to come to these things and want to grow and learn and get better about it. Okay, the last question, but we will end on a happy note. So let's go by this one kind of quickly. It never ceases to amaze me from forever how the climate change conversation and how global warming got into the political arena. And Jonathan, you're probably the best one to feel that. To me, it is not a political issue. The earth does not vote. the amount of carbon emissions in the air is not a political issue. It floats around and impacts all of us. How did it get there, and do you see it migrating a little bit out? Do you think that people are saying it's not a political issue, it's the environment?
Well, it's pretty sad, I think, in a way, that this has been politicized, and it's clearly been politicized by special interests who may lose if they we see a transition to renewable energy, for example. But one of the things that's important for everyone to realize is the scientist's job isn't to tell people what to do. And so often people are saying, you know, you scientists are saying to do this or that. That's not our job. Our job is just to tell people what's happening, why it's happening, what it means for the future. And the next thing about climate change is, you know, basically every scientist understands that it's happening, and it's happening primarily due to human causes. There's not a single peer-reviewed paper in the literature, not one, that says otherwise. And so I wonder what you think the public perception, Mrs. Green, this is a question for you. What's the public perception of climate change if the scientists are pretty much 100% the climate scientists?
I think it's really sad, but some of the recent natural disasters has helped to shift the mindset. It's been at the tragedy of human life and destruction, but I think people that are more conservative put it in that arena to say yes to this issue being an environmental issue as opposed to political. I think they're looking and saying, how can you deny it? Look what's happened.
You're right. And so what's interesting is that the public perception has been up in the 60 to 70 range percent of Americans feel that climate change is occurring. It's occurring because people are causing it, some of it, and we should do something about it. All those numbers are in majority of Americans. And recently, for the reasons you state, all these increasing disasters related to climate, the numbers are getting up, pushing 80% of Americans. And we just recently had John Krosnick, a very well-known psychologist, come to visit us from Stanford, and he's been polling for a long time. And one of his most interesting results is that politicians, whether they're red or they're blue, doesn't matter. If they talk about climate change as the science says they should, it's existing, it's because humans, we need to do something about it, their campaigns will be helped. But of course, they're getting money from the special interests in some cases to play down climate change or to say it's a hoax or other crazy things like that. And what I really worry about, and I hope you can bring us back to a happy note, because what I worry about in my sleep, when I don't sleep, is that what it's going to take is the same thing it took in Australia, where they had to have the worst drought they've ever had, complete with fires that were killing lots of people, and literally changed the whole way the country looks at its environment. Do we really want to wait for Mother Nature to spank
us? For that wake-up call.
Right, and it's going to happen sooner or later. It would be much better to get ready for that and to hopefully start acting so that the climate change wouldn't manifest this way in such a devastating manner. Okay, so as a father of children, I'm hoping we do that. But as a scientist, I just want to keep telling people what's happening, why, and what it means for the future.
Right. And I've heard you speak and really emphasize that. We're just reporting what we observe. That's what scientists do. It's not a political commentary. And that has to get people's attention, smart, consciously living people. It's like we're just reporting the facts here. We measure, we report, and we by those formulas, you have a crystal ball. So we just have to change some of the crystals in there. Diana, do you want to add to that?
Well, I would add that social science is also trying to do the same thing. Even though we work on social issues, we're not trying to tell people what to think. We're trying to say, doing research, this is what we can understand about public attitudes. This is what we can understand about behavior. If you do this, if you do that. And the one thing I would say in terms of the sort of partisan politics in the US around the environment is if you travel to other parts of the world, you don't see it in the same way. In Europe, almost all political parties are more around the environment. And I think there are some particular things here around the way our political system functions, but also some of the links between science and the very controversial debates around evolution, for example. So I think that as a social scientist, we can explain some of what's happening in the U.S., but I think the solution is to think about the future.
Okay, if you were not as enthralled as I was for this entire conversation, just wake up. It's like I rarely say that, but my listeners, go ahead quickly.
I just wanted to give people our website.
Yes.
Environment.arizona.edu if people want to find out more about the
Institute. And say that again, environment.arizona.edu. And I want to remind people, if you don't catch it, if you're listening on your iPhone or Droid, info@MrsGreensWorld.com, and I will link you up. I am a big, huge fan, supporter, and want to see the Carson Institute become world renowned. So thanks for being here with us. This is the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. Make it a great green week. Next week, Chris Jordan, environmental photographer.